to the Security Center in Getty. We're your hosts, David Swinniger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about cybersecurity. We're going to be doing something a little bit different today. We are going through the cybersecurity canon and pulling out the occasional book to read and doing a book report. The goal of the book report is going to be to, you know, determine what the high points of these books are, what the most important and relevant lessons are, and discuss those, and then talk about whether or not you should go ahead and read the entire book. I think we're kind of using Blinkist as an example here, except it's forcing us to read it and kind of dive into it in a little more detail.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
The first way of podcasting is be interesting. Well, shit. So for our first book of the cybersecurity canon that we are talking about, we are going to be doing The Phoenix Project, which if you heard the first way joke, you may have already known about. So we're going to do a couple things. We're going to do a real quick summary of the book. Then we are going to talk about what are the relevant thoughts. What are the most important ideas in the book that are worth thinking about? Then we're going to talk about the target audience and applicability of lessons and what you can apply to work tomorrow, next month, and over the next year. Finally, David's gone and picked out a couple books that might be a good extension if you decide you really like the book or you like the subject, some other things for you to read and continue to dive into. So I'm going to go ahead and start here with a real quick summary. I am not diving into this. It's actually a fairly readable book. I prefer my kind of, I don't want to say self-help, but I prefer my, you know, business books to have an overarching storyline that kind of ties it together and ties all the main points together. But in this one, there's a gentleman named Bill who is recently promoted to being vice president of the IT group. And he inherits a department that's kind of falling apart. His part of the group, they've been, just chugging along, keeping on going. But then he gets the whole group and he finds out that things are actually not going nearly so well as they thought they were. And what's going on here is security is always in the way. They're always focused on, audit findings. The change management process is cumbersome and time intensive, and therefore nobody follows it. Nobody knows all the work that's going on, all the different projects, both business and IT and all the other stuff. One person is a critical keystone for almost all projects. Major projects are rolling out that the company depends on. In this case, the big one, what they're calling Project Phoenix, is an omni-channel for sales that has been widely publicized for this publicly traded company, and everybody is expecting it, and the future of the company hinges on it. And the new vice president seems quite surprised by a lot of what's going on, even though he had been in the IT department. I think that's mostly because he'd probably been focused really on his own little segment of it. And overall, it's the story of migration to DevOps. It's written by Gene Kim. He's been kind of a DevOps devotee for a while. He's been talking about it at conferences for many years. That's the quick summary. So the first item is, what are the big ideas in the book? And we pulled out six things that are kind of the big thoughts and big ideas in the book. And this is not in order of importance. But the first one is, how can you manage production if you don't know what production is? So something about here is, are you seeing all of the work that's going on? Are you tracking all the work that's going on? Are you managing the level of work that is coming into your group and managing what's coming out of your group? What things that a lot of companies tend to do is they're prioritizing whatever the C-levels want that day and constantly rejuggling priorities. How do you validate that it actually gets completed? I'm sure all of us have been on projects where, following the 80-20 rule, like the first half of it's real easy to complete. Everybody's making good progress. Things are roaring along. And then as you start to get towards the finish line, it gets harder and harder to get, those corner cases. And frankly, a lot of the time what happens is people just start getting reprioritized before the work is actually completed.
Something else to consider is, how do you even decide to do the work which is asked for?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times in IT, that kind of gets shoved down your throat. You know, marketing or whoever decides on a new big project and they just volunteer IT into it.
This is where your measures come into play. Your ability to show whether that work is actually going to be valuable or not, or provide the returns that are expected.
Yeah, I don't know that IT security has ever really done that. I'm just thinking from like kind of projects that I've been handed off in the past where someone else has determined we're doing it. And then we're, you know, it's given over to IT security and like, here you go, secure this, or, you know, alert on this or whatever.
Yeah. I was actually asked one time about the, I don't know if feasibility is exactly the right term, but the concept of blocking webmail. And this was, you know, someone had asked me who was working for another organization who I guess was considering doing this, which they had not done before. And I had suggested that they take a look at what's the downside of not blocking webmail. Are you getting a lot of compromises from not blocking webmail in order to indicate how much savings there is or how much reduction in risk there is for actually undergoing the effort to do that blocking. And that's obviously a very simple example because that's something you can just change on the proxy. There's not a huge project involved. But it's just an idea about how you can look at what the trade-offs are and what the costs are from a security perspective.
Second major thing to think about is what is work? And this seems kind of silly, but his point in the book is there are four types of work, at least for IT specifically. There is the business project work that is kind of forced on you. There are the IT operations projects, you know, things like upgrading your servers, upgrading your mail system, et cetera, et cetera. There are changes, which are kind of the day-to-day bits of work. And then finally, and most importantly, there's unplanned work. He calls it anti-work, kind of going off the, you know, matter, antimatter thing, where unplanned work typically wipes out the rest of your work. You can have a whole week's worth of work planned. You know, I'm going to work on this project today. I'm going to work on this project tomorrow. And then that unplanned work comes in and just swipes it all away. And almost nobody accounts for this in their planning. They don't stop there and think about how much time needs to be just left open for this type of unplanned work. And if you have a lot of unplanned work and you're spending a lot of your time firefighting, this starts what Gene Kim calls the IT capacity death spiral, because the more unplanned work you have, the less time you have to work on your other projects, which means the other projects don't get the full attention they should have, and they're going to need more unplanned work down the road.
And this is something that kind of ties back into what we were talking about a second ago about tracking work. So if you're able to track the work you're doing and planned for, as well as being able to track whatever unplanned work you do, then you're able to put some metrics around how much unplanned work is actually funneling into your team and how much regular work is being displaced by that unplanned work.
Yeah, and this is one of the places where he had a diagram that just made so much sense to me. I couldn't believe that I never thought of it before. Where generally speaking, if you are, this has to do with how much time you have to work on unplanned work and get those last minute priorities done based on your capacity. If you are at 50% capacity and there is unplanned work of 1 hour, you'll generally have to wait 1 hour to complete that unplanned work. Whereas if you are 90% occupied and you have an hour's worth of unplanned work, you may have to wait 9 hours to get it done. And if you're 99% occupied, now you're waiting 99 hours. It is, I don't think it's geometric, but it definitely seems like it's exponential. The more crammed your schedule is, the longer and longer you have to wait. And especially on a project that is not correctly prioritized, where the work is coming in last minute. And if you have a bunch of handoffs, you can wait weeks and weeks and weeks for the actual work. And that's actually a big thing in the Toyota production system, where they talk about like the hands-on time and the wait time between stations, but it's just as relevant in IT work as well. If everybody is 90% plus busy and you've got, you know, maybe 8 hours of work divided over three people to do, you may end up waiting several weeks for that work to be done because everybody's so busy that trying to fit it into the schedule may take, you know, weeks of time.
Right. The simple math that they have in the book is busy time over idle time. So if you're 50% busy and 50% idle, that's just one unit. Whereas you keep moving that busy time up, the idle time goes down, and you divide the idle time into the busy time. By the time you get down to 99% busy and 1% idle, that ends up being 99 units versus just one unit.
I recently saw an article that was very similar to this that was discussing why administrative assistants seldom have all of their time filled. And it's precisely because of this unplanned work. When, you know, the C-level or your leadership team needs the administrative assistant to accomplish a task, they don't want to wait, you know, 10 hours, 20 hours, 3 weeks for it to get done. They need to get it done right then. And they seem to understand this by having them have a lot of idle time that frees them up to take care of emergency tasks as they show up. And I've seen this kind of taken in a couple different ways for IT. That may mean that if you are, for example, a tier one or a tier two SOC analyst, you typically will not have projects because you need to be free to handle that IT alert, or whatever project you have can't be time sensitive. It can't be on a schedule, because you need to be free to take those alerts and those incidents that could come in at any time and take up all your time. On other teams, I've seen recommendations of having things like trying to make sure you've got 20% idle time, 20% of unplanned time during the week to handle these types of things.
Right. Basically, a SOC analyst work is all unplanned, as it should be.
Yep. Well, and they may work on other things, but those things just aren't, they just can't be time sensitive, because who knows when they'll actually get completed.
Forever.
I've definitely spoken with companies in the past where, in order to handle this, in order to provide the analyst with, you know, more project work and more kind of productive work rather than just burning out on alerts every day, they'll put an analyst on for a week and off for a week. And when they're on, they have all unplanned work. And then when they're off, they spend their time building tools or improving dashboards or building analytics, things like that. So, but again, while they're on, there is no planned work. It is all unplanned.
Right.
So you've managed engineering teams. Do you guys try to build in idle time into your schedules?
We try. It's virtually impossible. But the key to being able to get that time built in is to be able to collect those metrics on what's being worked, so that you can show back to leadership about how much time you're spending on planned work versus unplanned work versus projects versus IT projects and all of that. To show that that how much that unplanned work, which you're trying to minimize, is eating into the ability to get other work done. And the fact that when you have someone who's 75% busy and 25% idle, that any single task that you assign to them takes X number of time longer because they lack that idle time that's necessary.
Yeah, I know. Really chaps the ass of management not to see people busy all the time.
Oh yeah, there's a particular CIO that I had a conversation with that was quite adamant about not seeing someone at their desk first thing in the morning or at their desk all the time.
The next major talking point that he had in there was on work in progress, which is very much a manufacturing term, but it does have applicability kind of in IT and IT security engineering. He called it the silent killer of due dates. And basically what that has to do is it has to do with needing to control when you are releasing a new job and when you're releasing the materials. And the reason for this is that every process has a bottleneck. In the book, it's a guy named Brent. Brent is involved in literally everything. In every workflow, there's a machine, process, person, or material that limits everything else. In IT security, it's usually not a material. It's usually not a machine, although it may be. It may be, you know, spinning up new servers. Frequently, it's a process or a person that's kind of the limit. And speeding up anything, anywhere but the bottleneck is just an illusion. And this can include handoff between work centers. We talked above how if a resource is heavily occupied, every time there's a handoff, the wait time may be multiple times the however long it takes to actually complete the work that needs to be done there.
And this is how a job that actually takes 5 minutes to touch time can take 5 hours to actually get done.
Yep, it's the handoffs and it's the wait time. And manufacturing, actually, this is a very well understood process in manufacturing. It just hasn't really made its way over to IT yet. So the way to eliminate this is to identify the constraint. This is frequently a person. And in some ways, this person has created themselves as the bottleneck by getting themselves into too many things. And that can be benign. That can be because the person, you know, is trying to do, you know, wants to do stuff, or it can be less benign where the person's trying to make themselves, you know, a critical part. And, you know, maybe they're trying to get a promotion. They want to get involved in as many things as possible. But you have to identify that bottleneck. You have to exploit the constraint or the bottleneck, make sure it's working 100% of the time. Because every time that bottleneck is not working, something else is suffering and waiting. And then you have to set the tempo of work to however fast the bottleneck can push work through. So if you've got one person that's a key part of multiple projects, that person is going to dictate how fast those projects can move forward.
And obviously, if they're on multiple projects, they can only technically or actually work on one thing at a time.
Yeah, and that's where you go back to that. If a resource is 90% occupied, like maybe they're working 10% on this project and 10% on that project, and now you've got long wait times in addition to the fact this person's a bottleneck.
Right, and it kind of goes into what you were mentioning a minute ago about the work center. So if a piece of work has to go through a work center that has, you know, the machine, man, method, or measures all within there, and any one of those four things is necessary to complete multiple projects, that's where you're going to see the slowdown at. It could be the person, it could be the machine, or it could be the method that actually causes that bottleneck.
I mean, and materials is still a thing here too. Like if you don't have the right tool, if you've got to download the tools or, you know, purchase a tool.
Right. If you have to build a server, for instance, you know, and you need four servers for four projects and you can only build them.
Yeah.
In serial, then, you know, one is always going to wait on the other.
So, and then finally, if possible, you need to eliminate the bottleneck. And that usually involves, you know, bringing other people in. If it's because of a highly skilled position, then you need to be training people. You need to be writing standardized work and procedures so that other people can accomplish this. I don't think you can be a successful group if you let one person bottleneck all of your projects. So, and that's hard because being a Brent is fun. Like if you're the Brent, if you're in demand and everybody wants a piece of you, like that's a cool place to be as an employee. Cause it means that you're super important. It's unfortunately, it's really bad for the business too.
And one of the things I've seen with individuals who are kind of in that role, they don't really want to write down or document what they do.
That's boring.
Well, also they're too busy to, they claim that they're too busy to do it. So it's really difficult to move them away from being that bottleneck or the constraint.
Yeah, I think what they did in the book was actually brought in people to document for him rather than having Brent document.
Well, what they did was they shuffled everything to someone else. And then he was only brought in when they couldn't do it. And one of the requirements of bringing him in was to document what he did.
Gotcha. It's funny, reading this made me realize that I was being a Brent at work. Like I was on too many projects and I was being the bottleneck on a bunch of stuff. I really enjoy being a Brent.
But of course, this is helping change your ways, right?
I mean, yeah, trying to do that right now. So the next one was something they called the three ways, which I'm sure that this is pulled from manufacturing, as most of this is, or pulled out of DevOps. The first way is to create a fast flow of work as it moves from development and IT operations. This is part of what we were talking about before, reducing that wait time, getting it directly into people's hands. The second way, shorten and amplify feedback loops to fix quality at the source to avoid rework and unplanned work. And in the book, they were talking about issues with the code base, and it was like people were making fixes to the raw different versions. Like they were reporting errors from one version, but development had already created different versions, and there was a lot of versioning issues, and there was too much time between when things were being reported and when things were being incorporated. And a big here is a big thing here is to amplify, shorten, amplify those feedback loops so that the right people are talking to the correct people and they're doing it very quickly. The idea being is that if you fix the quality all the way at the beginning, then you don't know you have doing way less work overall. Finally, the third way is to create a culture that fosters experimentation, learning from failure, and understanding that repetition and practice are prerequisites to mastery. And this is something I'm definitely seeing in my son, for example, where he doesn't understand that repetition and practice are how you get to be good at something. He just wants to be good at something.
Everyone would be like to be naturally great at stuff, right? And this is like what we were talking about in the when we're talking about the IR plan in the previous episode about needing to do tabletops and exercises to build in that muscle memory.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people like to point at child prodigies. I think it was, what was it, Mozart, who was apparently a composer at 11, but they fail to point out the fact that his father was a music teacher and many of his early symphonies may not have actually been composed by Mozart. They may have been composed by his father.
I hadn't heard that, but wouldn't be surprised me.
Yeah, I recently heard it. I should quote my sources, but I can't recall where I heard it at the time. But he'd been practicing for years, even at age 11. The fifth one is outcomes are what matters in business. This one can be tough sometimes in security. Typically in security, like we're really focused on, you know, incident response or, you know, getting this product out securely. And sometimes that's not exactly what the business needs. The business doesn't necessarily need a 100% secure system. They need a secure enough system.
Right, understanding those trade-offs.
Yeah, a lot of times security is not really brought into the business discussion, so we don't necessarily know exactly. And then this is, I referred to this earlier, like a lot of times security is kind of brought in at the end and they're told, you know, make sure this is secure, sign off on this before it's put into production. And they're too late at that point to actually change anything. And there's a ton of pressure for them to sign off on it because you don't want to be the no-sayer, because that's what everybody thinks of security is. It's just no, no, no.
That's why they're brought in at the end, where it's difficult for them to say no versus being brought in at the beginning to say
exactly.
No.
Yep.
Not to say that security should say no. I mean, security's job should really be, you know, how can I help you do this correctly versus saying, no, you can't do this.
You know, it's almost like improv where they talk about how in improv, you're never supposed to say no to anything. You're supposed to say yes and. So like we can put this into, is this ready to go into production? Yes. And we can throw a application firewall in front of it or something. So in here, he describes one security guiding principle, which is you win when you protect the organization without putting meaningless work into the IT system, which makes sense to me because I do feel like a lot of auditors specifically are really focused on gotchas, so to speak, as was mentioned earlier. And that puts a lot of work into the system. All right. And the final point is improving daily work is more important than doing daily work. And this is something that I personally really struggle with. There have definitely been times where I'm sitting there and I'm being like, all right, a script can improve this. And then I'll do a quick mental calculation. So for an example, let's say that there is hypothetically a report that needs to be transferred over and it's done once a month at the end of the month. Comes in, you know, maybe a CSV file or something. You could write a script to do that report and compile that report for you. And you do the mental calculation like, all right, well, it take me, you know, X number of hours to write the script. And, you know, it takes me 10 minutes per month or 15 minutes per month to do this. You know, how many months would have to go by before writing the script is worthwhile? So I tend to unfortunately do a lot of those kind of calculations, and I almost always end up deciding it's not worth it because my scripting skills are so poor. It takes me so long, but that completely ignores the fact that if I improve my scripting skills, then it goes faster and faster.
Is that back to that practice and repetition? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was actually at an office where they were spending, they didn't have a tip. So they were spending 2 to 4 hours a day curating IOCs. Wow. And I'd spent about 40 hours writing the script to do that for them. And we cut that down to 15 minutes a day.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious improvement for sure. So the book recommends 20% of cycles to improving daily work. And as called out, it, due to entropy, if you're not improving things, they're just naturally getting worse. You know, your searches may be breaking in your sim because a data source changed. Your detections may not be relevant anymore. The attackers may have been moving on to new types of techniques. It's not just writing scripts. I know that we both kind of focused on that, but it's, you know, making sure your searches are still good, making sure threat intelligence says you're still looking at the right stuff. It's making sure your data sources are all feeding in, all that stuff. All that stuff is kind of security technical debt.
And this kind of goes back to those metrics we were talking about a bit ago, is try to collect metrics on everything you can in order to be able to evaluate those metrics yesterday versus today and into the future, to be able to see whether you're actually making improvements or not.
Yep. So those were the big thoughts that came out of this book. There were a lot of, there's some other little ones that were really interesting, but I think those were the six big ones. The target audience and applicability of the lessons. You have in here that it was mostly IT and security operations engineers, and I agree with that. Although there are a lot of lessons from the Toyota production system and manufacturing that I think are definitely applicable to security operations centers, although they mostly weren't in this book because they're mostly around things like daily management, stuff like that.
Well, engineering teams should really function like service teams. You know, they are there to provide services to the rest of security operations. So they can very much take advantage of a lot of the things which were identified within this book that apply to general security, general IT operations, and should be treated in the same manner.
All right. So what can you apply from this book to your work tomorrow? I think the big one to me is the sharpening your axe / improving your daily work. This is something that I've definitely pushed when I've run security operations teams, focusing on improving your detections, building new detections, trying to find good ways of keeping tabs on your existing log sources, your existing detections, validating that things work the way they should. I think that's always time well spent. And that's something that you could start off on either a daily basis, or you can start off on a weekly basis, you know, set aside 4 hours on Friday. Do like kind of a Friday afternoon projects thing where you work on improving stuff, or do like an hour each morning to do. Now, obviously you should go and, you know, make sure it's cool with your manager. Although I think that they'd be happy with that. So, and that seems like that's hard to get people to do. Again, speaking from my experience as a manager, you can tell people to do it, and a lot of times they just kind of keep rolling on and doing the stuff the old fashioned way.
Yeah. I would say the daily is really the better way to go for two reasons. One, it's actually a shorter block of time, which is easier to actually have versus being able to cut off 4 hours. And daily work reinforces much better than weekly work. So doing something every day reinforces better than doing something just once a week.
That makes sense. So the second thing you can apply to your work tomorrow is that outcomes are what matter in business. When you're working on your stuff, try to think about, how is this improving business outcomes? Does it apply to business outcomes? I feel like there's an awful lot of things that we do in security where we're basically just making work for ourselves and spinning our wheels. And we look super busy and we feel super busy, and we go home at the end of the day and we're like, what? Look at how many things we accomplish.
Well, you're able to say we accomplished something at the end of the day?
Yeah, look how many emails I answered. I mean, that's the classic one, right? Like the average business person answers like 2 or 3 hours worth of emails in a day. And most of those emails are not really related. That's not your job. That's not usually what you're hired for. I mean, unless you're a manager, maybe your job is to kind of coordinate things. But, you know, security engineers shouldn't be answering 3 hours worth of emails a day.
Well, that's one thing that it's not referenced in here, but there was actually I'm going to mention another podcast, but don't be too upset about it. Art of Manliness had a podcast a few months ago now that was talking about how email is killing us.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I took away from that was to take work. Don't ingest work via email. Use a ticketing system or a designed work ingest method to intake work, and get away from getting work via email and adjusting work via email.
Yeah, was that Cal Newport?
Maybe. I don't remember.
I think he recently wrote a book. He wrote a book called Deep Work, which was really good.
Yes, that's
but
him.
He also
that's
wrote him. A book on email a little, although again, yeah, no, I, so that's one of the things that I've started doing recently. I set up my calendar each week so that I only look at email for less than an hour a day. I have half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the afternoon to look at email. And part of that too, is you have to be willing and able to look at the email and be like, does this add value? Does this add real value? And throw out the email, just stick it in your completed folder if it doesn't.
Yeah. One suggestion I would have is if you can do it, get away from email distribution lists that are accessible from outside your team. Because what will happen is you have someone outside your team which attempts to send work into your team by sending it to that distribution list. So you've got multiple people taking time to consume that email, and you may have multiple people end up working on it at the same time, in addition to that coming in via email versus a ticketing system or some other work ingest.
Yeah, that was called out in the book. People directly calling Brent for like their private projects and retasking him. Like that's if you're a manager, your job is prioritizing work for your team. So it should come in through you and you should assign it.
Well, not necessarily through you, but it should come through a dedicated method for work ingestion that has a process and a plan behind it. So it may not come into, I mean, if you want to come through you as a manager to allocate work to you guys, that's a method, that's fine. But if it
doesn't go through the manager, like how does the manager know that priorities are being kind of run through correctly?
Well, if you have your prioritizations already set for your team and they understand when the work comes in, where that falls within your already preset priorities, that can go in the backlog in the appropriate space. So if you can design this and trust your team to follow that, that will save on some challenges right there.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially for a security operations team where the work is kind of well-defined, you know, request for new alert, you know, emergency, the slug source isn't working, stuff like that. Stuff that has a defined structure you can prioritize and then dump it in the queue for sure.
Right.
So I guess I was thinking more on like the SOC side where, you know, people start calling in. We you know, you get a lot of emails, like you were talking about, emails directly to the distribution list with like, hey, here's this weird email that came in, or hey, I need you to look into my computer, it's acting weirdly and stuff like that. So that type of stuff, again, doesn't necessarily need a manager, but that's the kind of stuff that tends to really mess with queues. All right. What can you apply to your work next month? Well, a couple things here. Seeing and tracking work, starting to count the number of hours you're spending on things, making sure you know what you're working on and what's taking up all of your time. Prioritizing and making sure that you are keeping to those priorities, which is what David was talking about a minute ago.
And you can adopt a Kanban type work management by using like Trello, or ServiceNow has visual task boards to help you leverage Kanban within, if not for your team, you can do it for yourself.
Yep. And the idea of Kanban is making sure that work is in front of you, that you can see the work and everybody else can see how much work is being done and who's doing that work and what's kind of stacking up in the queue. So, and then finally, what can you apply to working over the next year? Well, you can use the tracking above to start forecasting your next year and trying to get a handle on how much work is actually being done. This was a big surprise to them in the book. And I think it's a pretty much surprise to everybody how much work is actually being done, how many different projects are underway at any given time. This will help you demonstrate the value with your team to the larger group. And then you can start doing some of that adding things like the three ways and figuring out how your work is separated with the business project work versus IT operations project versus changes versus unplanned work. Once you've been tracking that work for a while, it'll really help you get a handle on what type of work you're doing and what type of work you can expect in the future.
And regardless of where you're at within your organization, you can still leverage the concepts within this book for yourself or your team as well. And if you are able to accurately and consistently collect those metrics, you may actually be able to influence the broader team. You know, if it's just yourself, maybe your entire team to adopt those methodologies, or if your team is using it, to be able to take that up to the next level and maybe have the broader team start adopting these methods as well.
Yeah, once I started to track exactly what I was spending my time on and how much time I was spending on stuff, I was shocked at how little time I actually spent doing what was ostensibly my job. So there was so many hours in meetings, so many hours in like team activities, so many hours and things that, yeah, there were frequently I would find that half or less of my time each week was actually, you know, building stuff or working on projects or content development or whatever.
If you read this book, there are several books that were mentioned within there. One of the prominent ones is The Goal, a process of ongoing improvement, which is kind of like the Phoenix Project for manufacturing. And they reference in there that a lot of MBA programs have this as required reading, as well as the DevOps handbook, how to create world-class agility, reliability, and security in technology organizations. And depending on which edition of the Phoenix Project you get, it may come with a few chapters from the DevOps handbook as well.
And I saw they actually had a sequel to the Phoenix Project too, which I haven't read yet.
Beyond the Phoenix Project, I think.
Yeah, something like that. All right. Well, I'm all Phoenix Project out. Our project is over.
That's all the time we have. So thanks for listening to the Secure Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec. And of course, download and listen to us on your favorite podcast app.